The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. And I just returned yesterday from teaching a 7-day retreat at our retreat center in Santa Cruz. And so there was a lot of teaching and a lot of kind of immersion in the practice in a wonderful way. And looked at the calendar and saw that I was supposed to give a talk today here. The day after, at the end of that retreat. And so I feel quite happy, but I don't really feel like I have anything to say. I've kind of been, you know, said it all. So it occurred to me that we could just do questions and I could try to respond and have a discussion. And maybe we'll do that at some point. But I thought, well, maybe also I should say something. So some of you kind of expected something, and if I didn't, come from far away. Some people I know. Some people look at the IMC calendar and see who's speaking, and come a long way. Just so the pressure is on. and then I know very well that in thinking about today that. And now, a little over a week into the new administration here, many people, it's quite concerning for many people, and many people are quite consumed and disturbed, and it's difficult for them. And so then I thought, well, you know, this is an important time, and so important time to say something that addresses that in some way. But I feel kind of, you know, I just kind of emptied myself and to come and kind of come here and address the times in some effective way is not really, you know, it's not that happening. It's in a coherent way. But I do want to say a few words that maybe kind of brings all these currents of thoughts, what's going on in me, together here at this point, this time. And hopefully in doing so, it's relevant for enough of you as well. When I was a young Zen student, the Zen teacher, the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, he gave a talk, a Dharma talk. And I don't remember much of the talk, but he said something very significant for me. He said Gandhi's contribution, Mahatma Gandhi's contribution to humanity is the importance of sitting. And, you know, some meditation. So, and that was kind of like a, in a very, kind of almost symbolic way of saying something. You know, maybe that the Buddha's contribution was to humanity was to sit and do a deep introspection and look at the roots of suffering and hate and fear in ourselves and see through it to the possibility of awakening to freedom, to deep abiding peace, inner peace. So he said, you know, the Buddha's contribution, no, what did I say? The Buddha's contribution is to sit. Mahatma Gandhi's contribution is to humanity is that it matters where you sit. So the Buddha's contribution is to sit. And so, you know, it's one thing to go sit at a, you know, nice retreat center in Scotts Valley and sit and meditate. It's another thing to sit in, you know, in the south side of Chicago. You know, where do you sit? Or, you know, I remember in the 1980s, friends of mine would sit on the railroad tracks where they brought material to make nuclear weapons or research over in Livermore. So they would block the trains. And they'd sit there peacefully meditating, they're minding their own business, you know, focusing on their breathing. And and that just happened to be doing it on the train tracks. And so, so this idea of where we sit, where we bring our practice, is something that's very poignant kind of topic. And so, in the Buddha's time, There's two stories, and chances are they're mythic stories, but I think that some of these myths, you know, represent something. And one of them has to do with a neighboring king who was a neighbor from a neighboring country next to the home country of the Buddha. And this king had certain animosity against the people of that country, the Shakyan people. The Buddha was a Shakyan. So he had some animosity. He'd been slighted by them, apparently, insulted, and so he wanted to have revenge. And so he set out with his army to conquer this neighboring country, destroy it, get his revenge. And when the Buddha heard that this was happening, the Buddha went out and to a road, just on the road, he sat just inside the border of his own country. And he sat in the middle of the road in the full sun, sat and meditated. And the king with his army comes along the road, and there's this monk sitting there, blocking the road, just sitting there. And so apparently there's a tradition, you don't just kind of march ahead when the monk is sitting there, or march over the monk or something, out of respect. So the king got down and went over and said, you know, what are you doing meditating here in the full sun? Just over there, very close by, there's a big tree with beautiful cool shade. Why shouldn't you be sitting over there? And the Buddha said, I'm sitting, I get all the cool shade I need from my my fellow clans people, my people of my clan, people of my country. My fellow country people, they provide me my shade. And the king understood. And so he turned around and went home with his army. So the idea that we get support, we get shade, we get nourished, we get something from our people, and that human connection is what the Buddha evoked, that we had this connectedness that he felt, and maybe the king kind of recognized the human basic connection that people have with each other. Then there's another story where maybe it's the same two countries, but they shared a river called Rohini. And this Rohini River, there was a drought, and the farmers on either side of the river depended on the river to water their crops. So the river, the level of the water dropped so much that there was just enough water to water the crops on one side or the other. And so each side wanted to have the water so they wouldn't, And so they, I think they started trying to dig irrigation canals or do something. And there was all this conflict between these two sides about this water. And the conflict between the farmers escalated, and they got their local village involved, and the local village got their local country involved, who got their local armies involved, who got their local generals involved, who got the local war ministers involved. So it escalated, right? And so the armies got armed and started marching towards each other to have this battle. And so the Buddha heard about this. So he went and put himself right between the two armies. And he said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we're going to war." "And what's the cause of this war?" And he asked the Minister of Defense, "Oh, I don't know, you have to ask the general." And the general said, "I don't know, you have to ask, you know, someone else down the line." "I don't know, to ask someone else down the line." So the Buddha went down the line, and finally it came to the local farmers. And they said, "Well, there's the issue of the water. And there's not enough water for both sides, and we want the water, because we're going to suffer if we don't get this water." And so then the Buddha addressed them all. And I think particularly the story says he addressed maybe the minister or the people in charge of the army, the general or something, and he said, How much is water worth? I know it's the value of water, buying water. He hadn't been to American supermarkets. Water's more expensive than milk now. The answer the general gave was, oh, water in itself is not so valuable. You know, it's not, doesn't cost so much. And then the Buddha said, well, what's the worth of the blood of a warrior? And the general said, oh, that's worth a lot. Are you going to sacrifice the blood of a warrior for something that's, you know, has very little value, the water? And so that stopped the war. So you know, it's a little mythic story, maybe symbolic, and you can probably, you know, criticize it or come up with reasons why it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. But I think in both these stories, it's an example of the Buddha stepping in to conflict, right into the middle of it, not hiding in the forest, but stepping right in the middle, and then somehow having something to do with it. Where he sits, where you are is important, where you stand. In both situations, the Buddha was committed to ahimsa, to being nonviolent. And so, in those situations, and certainly in the fairy tales like that, if that's what it was, you know, it worked out pretty well for him. There's another tale, I don't know if it's, we still don't know if it's true, but I think it's meaningful for me in the same regard. About 200 years after the Buddha, 150, 200 years, there was a king in India named Ashoka. And Ashoka was one of the first kings of India to unify much of India. He went out and conquered huge swaths of India and created a big empire. And apparently he was pretty ruthless. And the ancient histories that describe his battles and what he did describe, you know, that there were, you know, huge armies that met on battlefields and 100,000 people were killed and left, you know, dead and dying on these battlefields. And so one morning after one of these battles the king won, he was walking across the battlefield where all these corpses and wounded people were, gore and blood and everything was, the remnants of it was left over. So at least the way it's written these stories, it's kind of a graphic picture of something. And I don't think the stories, the history accounts, you know, say much about what the king was feeling. But then, lo and behold, walking across the field through the carnage was a lone monastic, a Buddhist monastic in the robes. And was walking very steadily and slowly across, calmly, peacefully. And there was something about the peacefulness and the calm of this monastic that in contrast to the carnage and the violence, the war that the king was familiar with, that got his attention. And so he went over to ask the monk something. You know, why are you so calm? Or what teaching do you follow? Or what's going on for you here? Something. He was curious. And the monk said something like, hate is never overcome by hate. By love alone is love overcome. This is the eternal truth. And that got the king's attention. And so then he became known, he was kind of radically reformed, and then he became known for being one of the great peaceful kings of India, who did it, who created, started taking care of the people, created animal hospitals and hospitals for people, and dug irrigation canals for his people, and kind of really supported people and was promoted peacefulness in his world. And he became known after that conversion experience as one of the more peaceful kings of ancient India. Maybe it's easier to be peaceful king after you've conquered everyone. And there's no one left to conquer. But anyway, the idea is, this is the story that's told of his conversion, seeing this monastic. And so again, this idea of where you go, where you are, what you do is important. And so here the monk, the monastic went, you know, is walking across the field. So the question for people who are practitioners, Buddhist practitioners, do the practice, is are you ready for the performance? It's kind of one of the oddities of the English language that Buddhists keep talking about practicing, practicing, practicing. What are we practicing for? You know, are we only going to practice, or when do we perform? And when do we step out from our meditation, meditating in the privacy of our homes or meditation centers like this? And when do we bring our practice, our meditation, our peace, or into the battlefield or into the public world in a way that can make a difference? And then how do we do it? I think that one of the great important aspects of the practice that we do is the emphasis. Its emphasis is, puts a tremendous emphasis on how we are. And maybe you could almost say how we are is more important than what we do. And so that how we are, meaning in this context what I'm talking about, is the how peaceful? There are people who've advocated for peace and they've done it violently. There are people who have devoted themselves to nonviolent work, but then they've had bitter fights and conflict with people within their own communities, you know, their own kind of organizers and stuff. And I knew people who, in the 60s, who were involved in the anti-Vietnam war demonstrations back then, who were so dismayed by how much anger, how much violence, how much authoritarianism there was, and how much sexism there was among these people who were organizing these anti-Vietnam War movements, that they left the movements or they went to look for something else that they could put their energy into that would make a difference rather than perpetuating some of the more unhealthy dynamics that could exist in our culture, even in the pursuit of peace. So how are we? You know, do we have a way of living with love? Do we have a way of living in a peaceful way? Do we have a way of living where we respect each other and care for each other? Do we have a way of living that we don't get caught by fear, don't get caught by hostility, we don't get discouraged? So we can step forward into the world. We can sit on that road when the armies come. We can walk into the battlefield when it's necessary. And we can take with us our sense of stability and clarity and peacefulness and the absence of fear, the absence of discouragement, the absence of, cowardice. You know, how are we? And so the practice that we do is a practice to touch in ourselves a certain way of being how, avoiding some hows we are and cultivating other hows. So no longer cultivating fear, no longer cultivating hostility within us and supporting it and reinforcing it, not cultivating giving up and pulling back, not cultivating agitation and preoccupation, but rather cultivating courage, peacefulness, confidence, an ability to stay present without being afraid, an ability to not avoid conflict, not avoid conflict, but also not cause conflict, but perhaps step towards it so we can feel it and be with it directly. But not to continue the conflict. So I think I said this recently that if someone attacks you verbally or physically, I think the ideal in Buddhism is not to walk away, not to turn the other cheek, not to, but also not to attack in return, but rather to stand there confident and strong and look the person right in the eye. And here I am. You have to take me into account. And we can talk, we can engage, but I'm here. I'm not going to back off. I'm not going to attack. I'm just here. Kind of in a symbolic way, that's kind of like the ideal in Buddhism, how that actually plays out in different situations is, you know, situational. And But the practice is preparing us for that. The practice of being able to have the stability, deep abiding stability and kind of confidence and that peacefulness that is a how we step forward. And that's certainly my wish, that one of the things that people who do this kind of practice offer the world, that we can go and offer a how. And so when other people are involved in actions, political actions or peaceful actions, whatever, that how of staying calm, how of staying peaceful, is contagious. It shows something that is supportive for other people and maybe keeps things in a peaceful way. So when the story I told you of the fight over the river and the water, and then, the Buddha said, you know, what is it? What's more valuable, water or the blood of a warrior? When the fighters backed off and decided not to fight, it said the Buddha recited these verses. Ah, that's part of the poem. Ah, so happily we live, without hate among those with hate. Among people with hate, we live without hate. Ah, so happily we live, without misery among those in misery. Among people in misery, we live without misery. Ah, so happily we live, without ambition among those with ambition. Among people with ambition, we live without ambition. Ah, so happily we live, we who have no attachments, we shall feast on joy, as do the radiant gods. Victory gives birth to hate, the defeated sleep in anguish. Giving up both victory and defeat, those who have attained peace sleep happily. So that's what I didn't have to say today. So if you'd like to say some words or questions, or it can be about anything at all, then it's open for the floor. And if you could say your name when you start, it would be nice. No, it's a green light. You have to push the button on the side.
Hello. Hello, my name's Stephanie. It's nice to see you, girl. So this week, I got to really feel how strong my practice is, because at the beginning of the week, I had my first big asthma attack in 20 years. Mm. And I had to call 911 and I had to go to the ER. And what was really... I didn't suffer. So my body was doing this thing where it was shutting down completely. It couldn't breathe anymore. There are reasons why I've had my first big asthma attack in 20 years. Some of you might be able to guess how much stress. But what was really, what I felt really, really grateful for was that this practice that we do allowed me to observe and be with what was happening to me as it was happening to me.
Fantastic. So that was the performance.
It was the performance of the practice that I've been doing.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Here in the front.
I was wondering about your most recent book, Buddha Before Buddhism, I think it's called. And it has lots and lots and lots and lots of commentary on a historic point. So I appreciate it from an academic point of view, even though I'm not interested in that part. So what are your suggestions on using these poems as a practice point?
Nice. Nice question. So the book I translated is considered to be the what I read from before was from the Dhammapada. Also translate what I translated many years ago. And then now I translated verses that are attributed to the Buddha that are considered to be maybe his earliest teachings. So they have a certain antiquity and certain value. You get a sense of what the Buddha was teaching before he systematized, developed this teaching into what we now call Buddhism. So it's a set of verses. And one of the things I find useful with any teaching, and sometimes it's easier with verses because they have a certain rhythm to them or kind of poetic quality, is to live with them for a while. And so, like, I lived with those verses for 20 years on and off. It took me 20 years to do the translation because I didn't do it that often. But, you know, I lived with it and came back to it and reread it. And sometimes it's nice to even memorize verses. Because when you memorize something, it lives in us in a different way. And if we read it and just kind of remember what it says. And so to just memorize four lines of a verse and then go around reciting it to yourself through the day and have it come back. And then it pops back up at unusual times. Oh, it's relevant here. Wow, I didn't think about it that way. And it kind of works its way kind of into the subconscious mind in an interesting way when you've memorized it. So you're living with it and reflecting on it and thinking about it. It's nice sometimes when you have either memorized something like that or just reading it to read a few lines after meditating. You know, if you're meditating, if you're particularly calm and settled after your meditation, then we sometimes reflect on teachings or take them in a different way than if we're, just glancing down and, you know, during a commercial on TV or something. You know, a very different way of taking it in. And then sometimes I found it nice with short teachings, and like verses, is to write them out, even write them out a few times. Because in the writing, also something, it's a different kind of engagement and kind of living in us more fully. So there's a whole art of contemplative reflection of sacred texts. So giving yourself, it's not like reading, you know, the newspaper or something. And you have to kind of get yourself in a special time, place, after meditation or in a quiet time of day. You don't read it in order to read as fast as you can. Let's just get through it as fast as we can, then we'll move on to other things. But rather, you read short chunks. There was a time when, especially when I lived in the monasteries, where I would read only a page of a Dharma book each day. And that one page would just blow me away. Like, oh, now I got a lot of work to do. This is a lot to take. This is a lot to handle. And then I would reread that page through the day periodically, two or three or four times. And so I lived with it, applied it, reflected on it, and then the next day I'd read the next page. So it takes a while to get through a book then. But the point is not to get through a book. The point is not to acquire knowledge. The point is to practice with it or to be affected by it or be changed by it in some way. So I'll tell you one more thing about, living with spiritual texts and practicing with them, and like these verses that I did, was one way of actually thinking about them is to reflect about not whether you agree or disagree with what you read. That's kind of like an instinct that many people have. And because we want to be right, we want to find it, we want to have an opinion and be smart that way, all kinds of things. And, you know, it's easy, it's relatively easy to decide what you like and what you don't like. And the chances are you don't benefit yourself personally by simply deciding you like or not like something. So it's in terms of being changed and for the better, you might just put aside the tendency to like or not like, or to rule this is right or this is wrong. But rather, if it's something that has been preserved for 2,500 years, it probably has some value for some people. And so to reflect in this way, in what way, in what circumstances are these teachings useful for me? It might be in 99.9% of circumstances the teachings are ridiculous, those particular ones. They just don't make any sense. But oh, in that particular circumstance, I think it makes sense there. This is a useful thing. This is a useful way, useful approach here. So even if it's 0.1% useful for you, that's better than the uselessness of right and wrong and I like and I don't like. So the idea is to stretch yourself and think, in what way is this useful? If you discover how it's useful, then you've benefited. Does that make sense? And then you're grateful. Okay, this is great. So that's a little bit.
I knew all that, but you're reminding me.
Okay, great. Someone else? It's you. Oh.
When you were talking about the Buddha turning people around, I was thinking about the people all over the country who are trying to turn around what they feel is injustice. And I felt so touched and so proud to see the peace of the people, no violence at all. And many of the symbols they carried were about love,
yeah,
not hate. And so, having had some experience as a protester, I have a renewed faith in people and becoming a loving force for change.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, and your name is?
Oh, my name is Trudy.
Good. I think many people felt encouraged by what happened last Saturday. I certainly did. I was worried because of the violence in Washington, D.C. the day before. And so I was worried that that might happen again and be counterproductive. And to see how peaceful it was all over the country and how many people came out, I was actually surprised to feel encouraged so quickly. And so happy it happened. And my hope is that, my own hope for what Buddhism has to contribute is not a party in conflict, but rather as a mediating force, as an ability to kind of walk into the middle. And certainly sometimes we want to walk in the middle and sit in the road and stop things, for sure. But not to stop it and stop what we feel is wrong in a way that's conflictive, but actually figure out a way that's mediating force between people, and so that our common humanity is found, our shared values are found, that we understand each other better, and we're not demonizing anyone. We're understanding kind of everyone's beginning to understand each other in a deeper, deeper way. And so even if we end up with disagreements, it comes from mutual understanding, which is often rare when there's conflict because people kind of recoil and come into camps. And so, it's, I don't know if it's naive, but I certainly hope that the kind of practice we do of sitting and being mindful and paying careful attention and having compassion translates to being as kind of, the Buddhists get seen as people who are, I don't know if neutral is the right word, but are welcomed into all circumstances because they're seen as having everyone's interest in mind, concern for everyone, and then are a mediating force where we can kind of find our way to solutions. So one more, and then we'll stop.
Oh, I'm Anne. I'm kind of confused and wondering if I'm being simplistic, because taking care of yourself, if you've got some kind of conflict, that you want some stability, and like the first concrete step you can take is having loving kindness for people that you disagree with. And I'm wondering why I haven't heard this, or if that's an idea that's just too simple right now.
So I'm not sure I completely understand, but let me. Part of what I understood is that definitely we should take care of ourselves, and having inner stability is part of that. Having loving kindness for oneself, compassion for oneself is part of that, really understanding ourselves really well, so we understand the sources of suffering inside of ourselves, how we contribute to it, and how we succumb to fear or hate, or succumb to how we get wrapped up in pain in a way that's not useful. And so when there's conflict with others, there's a variety of things that are useful, and one, a classic one in Buddhism, maybe this is what you're pointing to, is loving kindness. And which means loving kindness here means a basic attitude of goodwill.
Yeah.
And so to not automatically demonize people, but to be concerned for their welfare. You know, so we disagree, but you know, you're human, I want you to be happy. And let's, you know, they feel that you have their welfare in mind, you're not just trying to roll over them with getting your way or something, or you're not trying to, you know, attack them in return or something. And so there's cultivating loving kindness is a very important part of Buddhist practice.
Okay, so it is kind of a basic thing.
Yeah, it's a fairly basic. In our tradition of mindfulness, of Buddhism, there are four practices which are the kind of the foundation for what we do. There is mindfulness, loving kindness, generosity, and ethics. Okay.